funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is a typical workday for a professional archaeologist, and how has the discipline changed over the past 60 years? My guest this afternoon has been in a position not only to observe extraordinary advances in our understanding of how our ancient ancestors lived and died, but to contribute to some of the field's most interesting and important discoveries. Fred Wendorf is Henderson Morrison Professor of Prehistory Emeritus at SMU. He developed a taste for archaeology as an 8-year-old boy in Terrell, Texas, who kept hunting for arrowheads long after his schoolmates had moved on to other passions. His work first made national headlines in the 1950s when he worked with a team on the Midland Skull, which at the time represented the oldest set of human remains discovered in the New World. Since that time, he has worked all over the globe, finding evidence of domesticated cattle in the Sahara 2,000 years before the earliest evidence of it in Asia, and a megalithic calendar a millennium older than the one at Stonehenge. His new memoir is called Desert Days, My Life as a Field Archaeologist. Fred, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
I want to talk about for a minute about your first amateur experiences as this little kid out hunting for arrowheads. What just caught your attention?
Well, I hadn't realized that they were there. And suddenly my friends and I began to pick up one and then another of these arrowheads. And we realized from the shape and so on that they were arrowheads. We came back for several weekends making trips, but then as time went on, turns out I was about the only one who came back out. And my mother was encouraging me to have that interest. And she and I had a working relationship. She said, if you'll tell me where you're going and when you're coming back and who's going to be with you, then I'll let you go anywhere you want to go. And she was good for a word. And so I would gradually go down the creeks around Terrell and down towards Kaufman, and then on off further east in East Texas, and it was about my very good fortune that I was 12 years old, I met a fellow Dallasite named King Harris, and he was a more than just a collector; he was a very very knowledgeable amateur. And he, who later I hired to work for me and in charge of our laboratory there at SMU, but he was at that time I was a little boy kind of walking around the cases and looking at the artifacts, and he came over to me and he said, "Are you interested in archaeology, young man?" And I said, "Yes," and I have a little collection of things. And no, I thought it was a big collection, but anyway. He said, we talked for maybe 20 or 30 minutes, and he said, "Are you recording the numbers of the sites that you're hunting and collecting on?" I said, "No, I hadn't been." He said, "Well, you should start right now." And so he persuaded me and showed me how to do this, and every piece that came from a site got this particular number for that site. And he also said, you should mark these sites on maps. So I saw Conservation Service maps, and we marked the location of these sites. So I was beginning to do something a little more significant than just picking up arrowheads. And, of course, I met my first really professional archaeologist was a man who was digging a site for WPA days back down in East Texas. And I was 14 at that time. And while I was young, I was going to graduate from high school the next year at 15. And so was anxious when I heard about this gentleman being down there. I wanted to find out what a real archaeologist does. So I got his name and address from the University of Texas, and I wrote him a letter and asked if it'd be possible to come down and visit. And he said, "Yes, come on ahead." Then of course, I had to wart my mother to to make sure that she would take me down there, and she did. And I met this gentleman who was very helpful to me, and he showed me all around his site, and it was an interesting site with lots of stones with pits in them, and he said, "I think these are from pits from breaking nuts, so that they could even." There are lots of pecan trees between here and the river, he said, and that was probably the function of it. I was by that time, I was determined to be an archaeologist. And my family was appalled.
Your dad said go to medical school, for crying out loud.
Pardon?
Your father wanted you to go to medical school.
Oh, yes. My father wanted me to go to medical school, and he said my mother and father were divorced. And my father said, if you'll go to medical school, I'll pay your full expenses, son. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be an archaeologist. It stiffened the relationship a little bit.
And you actually had an appointment to West Point, but then were seriously wounded in the Second World War.
Well, I was told by my I should maybe tell you a little bit of a story. By the time I was 18, in fact, on my 18th birthday, I began to realize that my mother did not really have enough money to sustain me and through my college degree. I had 2 years behind me, but I knew I needed to go on. And I thought that maybe I should, and everybody was saying, Fred, when are you going to get in the Army? And all of my friends that were 2 years older than I was were pressing me. And so I decided I'd go down and enlist in the Army. And I thought that I'd made a deal with the Army recruiter that I would be called up in May after the end of the spring semester. But I about a month later, I was called up and to report I think it was January 10th that I was reported I was called up. And
at the age of 20, you were commanding 41 men.
Yes. Well, I was 2 years I was an enlisted man, and then I was commissioned, and I was in the 10th Mountain Division, which is an elite unit, and I was 20 years old and leading a rifle platoon in combat. And there's an old saying that I'm not sure how accurate it is, but I suspect it's very accurate, that lieutenants in charge of rifle platoons in the infantry have a life expectancy of 30 minutes in combat. Of course, I didn't believe that. I thought I would surely have better. But my number came up, and I was wounded rather seriously by a tree burst, and it paralyzed my right arm. It's still mostly paralyzed.
And so you came back home after you'd been initially treated, and you wrote a letter to Senator Rayburn to tell him that you wouldn't be able to accept your commission.
Well, my mother informed me just before we went into this battle that I was talking about that she had heard that Sam Rayburn was going to nominate me for a mission to West Point. Her motivation was to get me out of combat. And I had decided that I liked the Army, got along with it well, and I thought it was a very nice thing. But I believe that the notification of the decisions about who was going to be the candidates was in April. March 3rd, I was wounded. And one of the first things I knew was that I wasn't going to pass the physical exam it was a pretty big shock to me at the time. I spent 2 years in an Army hospital. But it was also a good side. By then, I knew that after I had been wounded about a week or 10 days, I knew that I wasn't going to pass the physical exam. And so I knew that I really did want to go back and try to be an archaeologist. And so one of the things that happened in the hospital, that after about 4 or 5 months of hospitalization, at which time they were able successfully to stop the pain in the arm, they allowed me to have 90-day leaves, one after another. And they said, you only have to go to a post-hospital or a medical center and have physical therapy and then go on about it. And so I would sign up and go to a university and sign up for an anthropology course, some around in Michigan, because I was at Battle Creek, Michigan, in the hospital. And I would, so I got to go to several places and schools and take courses from them. And by the time my 2 years were up, then that's maybe an interesting thing I'll tell you in a second. But by that time, I knew that I'd almost finished my junior year, and so I could go back to school and quickly finish my senior year and get my bachelor's degree. The Army, the military, I think, in general, had a rule that they probably developed sometime in World War I, that these neurological wounds, such as I had, where the nerve was cut,
right?
They needed to stay in the hospital for 2 years, for fear that they would. This was for officers, because they'd had some bad experiences where people they thought were permanently disabled and so on with nerve injuries, and suddenly they got some sort of a miraculous cure. And so the Army was and told me that right when I first showed up in the hospital in Texas, they said, "Now you're going to be hospitalized for 2 years."
We are talking with Fred Wendorf, who is Henderson Morrison Professor of Prehistory Emeritus at SMU. His new book is called Desert Days, My Life as a Feared Field Archaeologist. We'll hear more about that fascinating career in just a moment. Right now, we want to pause to talk to you about our spring membership campaign. Jeff Whittington is with me now. He is senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We would love to hear from you this hour at 800-456-5372. I fear, and I say this, I've been saying this almost every day, but I fear maybe we've violated the pledge interesting guest continuum, and our guest may be so interesting that you don't want to tear yourself away from the conversation and call 800-456-KERA or go online to kera.org. We do have a copy of Fred's new memoir, Desert Days, available when you join the station at the $120 membership level. It's fascinating. He's had a fascinating career, and we're thrilled to have him here in studio today. So please call in support of the program. You can get your very own copy of the book when you join at that level.
I have to tell you, the cover photograph alone is almost worth getting the book. The stories within it are fascinating, but on the cover is a photograph that I think Fred took himself, and there are two skeletons and from very ancient times, and all around them are these little pencils which point to all the places where they have been shot by arrow points and things like that.
Wow.
It's really interesting, and it really does give you a clue to the exciting things that you will find within the book. It is a great thing to have. If it's something that you'd like to pick up for yourself anyway, and it's time for you to become a member or renew a membership, why not do them all together at 1-800-456-5372. You can also go to kera.org online and make a contribution there.
And, you know, the news, and by the way, special coverage doesn't stop because of the membership campaign. We will bring you tonight on KERA 90.1 at 7 p.m., President Barack Obama's press conference marking his first 100 days in office. This is special NPR coverage that starts at 7 p.m. You'll hear from NPR's Robert Siegel and senior Washington editor Ron Elving and White House correspondent Don Gagne. And, of course, you'll hear from the president as well starting this evening at 7 p.m. on KERA. The conversations you hear during this hour, they don't stop either. We just take a quick break to remind you that this is listener-supported public radio. It is your public radio station, and it is your responsibility as a person who uses this resource, who listens to the programming here maybe day after day, maybe all day long, every day. This is your opportunity to take responsibility for it and send some money to the radio station.
We are really proud of the work that we're able to do for you, of the guests that we're able to bring to you. Fred Wendorf, it's amazing to think that he's also a resident of Dallas, because this is someone who, and we'll hear more about this in a moment, has made international headlines with his work for decades now. We would love to offer you a copy of Desert Days. I don't know why I can't say that. Desert Days, My Life as a Field Archaeologist by Fred Wendorf, when you join us now at the $120 level. Our telephone number is 1-800-456-5376. Or you can go to kera.org. You might want to set up a sustaining membership.
Yeah, you can join as a sustaining member and spread your contribution out to equal monthly transfers from your bank account to KERA's account. It's very easy. You can do it $5, $10, $15, or $20 a month, whatever you decide. But please decide to support the station right now at 800-456-5372 or at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Fred Wendorf, Henderson Morrison Professor of Prehistory Emeritus at Southern Methodist University. His new book is called Desert Days, My Life as a Field Archaeologist. If you'd like to support KERA at the $120 level, we can offer you a copy with our compliments when you call 1-800-456-5372. If you want to ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Fred, jumping ahead here quite a bit, how did you get involved in the Midland skull discovery?
Well, like almost all of the things that that I look to as very important things in my life, it was an accident. There was a young man about my age then. I was about 29, 30. And he had been he'd been a collector of artifacts, and he had he would go around to the oldest archaeological sites that he could find, and he would try to locate artifacts that the archaeologists had missed. And so he'd come to the museum in New Mexico where I was in the junior curator, and he'd asked around who could tell him how to get to a site out in eastern New Mexico called the San Juan site. He'd been turned down, and finally he went into the director's office, and the director called up one curator and they said, "No, I'm very busy. I can't do that." Number two or three of them. And then finally he said, "Let me call Fred. He's too junior to be."
You wouldn't turn him down.
To turn me down. And so it turned out, well, this young gentleman whose name was Keith Glasscock came out to my office out at the Laboratory of Anthropology in Santa Fe, and we sat down, and right away I liked him. First of all, he was a good husky and obviously in good physical shape. I learned that he was a pipeline welder, and those guys are in good shape or they don't make it because those pipes are pretty heavy and the equipment that they drag around is heavy too. So, and I had done some work with pipelines doing archaeology before that. He asked me if I could tell him how to get to the site, and it happened that I'd been there about 3 months before, and so I described the location and how to find it, and he got ready to go, and then I said, "Well, what else have you looked for early man sites and that had been dug by archaeologists?" And he said, "Well, the best place I know is in Midland, near Midland, Texas, and I don't believe there's been any archaeologists there." We discussed this a little bit, and he said there are some artifacts there that look like they're about 10,000 years old, like fulsome points and things of that sort.
These are a kind of arrowhead.
Yeah. So when we were getting ready to break up and he was going to go away, I said, have you ever found any ancient bones or anything like that? And he said, "Well, yes." He said, "I found a skull that was kind of badly mangled, though, and mashed up, probably stepped on by a cow," he said, in this place near Midland. And he described it some more to me. And then, just as he was leaving, he said, "Would you like to see that skull, Fred?" And I said, "Sure. It might be very important." And indeed it was, although it was a big challenge on how to determine that it was as old as it was.
Yeah, talk about that, because it was a subject of much debate at the time.
Yes. Well, I got together a group of about five of us who went over to the site, and a couple of them from Texas and a couple of them from New Mexico and myself, and Glasscock. And he took us over there, and he showed us where he'd found the skull, and there was a little hollow there and so on. And so we decided to do some little digging there, and we dug thing down about 6 inches and screened it very carefully and found some scraps of bone, but nothing we could really identify. Very shortly after that, I got to look at the skull after it had been put together by a specialist in that, and I realized that it was a very old-looking skull. And so we had a little beer gathering after this field work and near the site, and I asked everybody in turn, "What do you think we can do anything with this?" And one after another said, "No, I don't think it'd be worthwhile," and "No, I don't know," except for one man that was Alex Krieger, who was the Mr. Texas Archaeology at that time. And Alex said, I think you might could do something with that, Fred, and I'd like to work with you on it. And so I thanked him, and we arranged, and I went back to Santa Fe, where I was working, and I decided that I needed to get a little small grant, and I would go to the Winogrand Foundation for it. And so I wrote a one-page statement about what was what we found there and how I proposed to determine its antiquity, and ask him, please send me, I think I'll need about $2,500, and please send me a form to apply for a grant. About 5-6 days later, I got a telegram saying, congratulations, you've been awarded a grant for $2,500. Yeah. It's signed by the president of the Winogrand Foundation. Well, my scheme was a little bit different. I realized that the blowout, that is the wind, had scoured out a hole there. And I knew that we would have a very difficult time placing that skull in the various levels of sands that were around that hole.
If you just moved too much from the original.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we, what my thought was that we would use microchemistry. It had been used back in the 1847s or something like that, and not very successfully. There had been some groups at the University of California had done the microchemistry on the shell mounds, and that was more useful. And then they had done that on the fossil skulls in England, and that had worked out very well. So I called up a friend of mine who happened to be the head of Los Alamos. And his son was interested in archaeology. So I called him and asked him if he had anybody who could do a microchemical analysis on bones. And I said, I've got a described it briefly to him. There's a stratified site with different colored sands in it. And I wanted to determine if it was a fossil bone and a fossil human remains were in the same deposit for the same length of time, they would have a similar chemical composition. If they were in separate units or had been only recently interred in one, they would have different chemical constituents. And there seemed to be a very good chase to test this process or this hypothesis, because there were 5 different levels there, and each one of them had bones in them. And then down at the bottom was this human skull. But I couldn't leave. Maybe it was put in a deep trench or something like that. So we had the little pieces of the skull, and then we had little pieces of the animal bones. Some of them were horses, and some of them were mammoths, and some of them were, they were Pleistocene animals that were in the bottom levels. And the chemicals, and they sent them to Los Alamos, and they had chemists who did the analysis. And sure enough, the skull and the extinct animals had the same chemical constituents, and those that were above it had different ones.
So you were able to tell that it was how old?
Over 10,000.
Which was the oldest thing, oldest human remains ever found at that point?
At that point, yeah, in the New World.
Mm-hmm. And this made national news.
Oh, yes. It turns out, after we got the chemical analysis, I sent a copy of that off to my friend Krieger, and I said, why don't we get together and write a report? And so he came over for the 4th of July weekend, and Krieger was a genius. First place, when he hit a typewriter, it sounded like a machine gun. it was just going so fast. Well, he... We sort of had an outline, and we sat down and made a little outline of the book, and then this is what he would write, and he'd say, "Why you're doing this, why you're doing that, Fred, I'll do this," and so on. And then we would discuss what we'd written and modify and change it. Finally, we got it the way we wanted it, and Krieger said to me, "I think you ought to tell the local paper about this." This was the 3rd of July. So I called the paper, local Santa Fe paper, and told them we were going to issue a news story about it. And they had somebody out there with a photographer and so on. And we wrote a little, and I wrote a little story about how the skull was found by Glasscock and so on. And the next day, on the 4th of July, there was a big burst of news about the discovery. And that's how the thing really got out. Of course, I'm cutting here a little bit because it gets kind of boring after a while.
I don't know. It's all very interesting. The other thing I really want to get to, and we can talk a little bit about it now, and we'll take a break, and then we'll finish the rest of it. But you also made a discovery of a calendar that is similar. People would remember what Stonehenge is, but 1,000 years older.
Well, it's about 6,000 years a date. We have a radiocarbon date on a hearth that's right adjacent to this. And it's about 15 feet in diameter. It's a circular line of upright slabs, stones, not real big ones, but they could stand upright.
And this is in Africa. Excuse me.
It was in Africa, and it was at a place called Nabta Playa, where there are hundreds of archaeological sites out there, and we'd been working there for several years, and I had seen this stone ring and had decided that it was a house floor. There was also some stones that were larger than the others. And I had a graduate student, a young lady, who for some reason had gone by this same thing and had noticed these upright stones. And she had said she had noticed to herself that there two of these pairs of upright stones, one at one side of the circle and one at the other side, two stones in each place, set together, close together, that they, and then another one that was 70 degrees east of north. This first one is true north, and the other one was 70 degrees east of north. And she came to me and said, I want to show you something, friend. So I came over and looked at it, and very discouraged about it, you know. And she said, and she pointed out that these two markers are each one. And she said, doesn't the second group at 70 degrees east of north, don't they mark the time of sunrise in around 6,000 years ago? And I said, well, it looks like a real good idea, but it took me about, I was the director of this project, and it was kind of hard. It was down on the bottom of my pecking order.
Well, we'll talk in just a minute about how you moved it to the top of the list, and it became a very important discovery in just a minute. Fred Wendorf is my guest. He is Henderson Morrison Professor of Prehistory Emeritus at SMU. His new book is called Desert Days, My Life as a Field Archaeologist. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. If you are ready now to make your contribution to KERA in support of great programming like this, great interviews like this one, please give us a call now, 1-800-456-5372, or you can go online and do this at kera.org. Jeff Whittington is back in the studio with us. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We'd love to hear from you at 800-456-5372. We would love to see your contribution come across the web from kera.org. It just takes a couple of minutes for you to do your part to support the public radio programming here in North Texas that you rely on every single day, that you listen to, and that you use. And we're asking you to do it because, you know, it's your public radio station, and it's listener-supported, and you're a listener, so it makes sense. We're not selling you something that you don't already use. It's the easiest product in the world to sell because you're already using it. It's just the getting you to pay for it part is what's challenging.
It's challenging, and yet if you are someone who knows that great things happen in a community because people take action to support them, then it shouldn't be such a hard sell. What's hard sometimes is convincing yourself to actually make the call. And I can tell you, having done this both ways, either online or via the phone, the whole transaction usually takes well under 2 minutes, and it's pleasant and easy. You'll feel great about it. You can know that you are, as Jeff said, supporting stuff that you're already listening to. Nothing here that you're paying for will sit on a shelf. Nothing will go unused. You will come back to the station, as you already do, day after day, year after year, and enjoy KERA's programming.
And there's no buyer's remorse, because the minute you get done with your transaction, you can come right back to the program. You can listen while you're doing it, as a matter of fact, and you can say, you know, I know what I'm supporting, and I know why I'm doing it. It's because it's programming that I like, programming that I use, and I want it to be strong and to be high quality and to be a continuing presence in my life. So please call 800-456-5372 or pledge online at KERA.org. Ray Sousa in Frisco did it. Ray renewed his membership. Tracy Plackemeyer in Arlington made an additional gift. Thank you so much, Tracy. We also heard from Graham Hobart in Plano and Catherine Rose in Dallas, who made an additional gift. Thanks so much to each of you. Please be the next one to call or to contribute online.
You know, you may remember the first time you turned on public radio being struck by how different it was. And at first, maybe it was unsettling. You thought, what is this? I'm used to sort of talk radio being a certain way. And then once you get adapted to the rhythms of public radio and the depth of information and the kinds of content that we're able to explore here, it's really hard to break away. It's hard to go back to something that is only going to feed you little, you know, pelt you with sound bites throughout the hour. We try really hard to bring you substantive content, and we are excited that every day we have different topics and things that we're able to explore. It's such a privilege to be able to talk to someone like Fred Wendorf about a 60-year career in archaeology. It's extraordinary. And this is something I can tell you that when I worked in commercial radio, I would not have been able to do. And your participation as an audience of listeners and also as a community of financial supporters is what makes it all possible. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org.
Thanks to Holly Schur in Fort Worth for renewing her membership. Jim Walsh in Dallas also renewed. We have $226,000 left to raise, Chris. We won't do another membership drive until the fall. That is our promise to you. So please don't wait. Please consider maybe giving an additional gift like many of you have. Consider joining at one of the higher levels. If you've been thinking for years, you know, I should support KERA. If you've got a library full of books by authors that you've heard on this program or other programs on KERA, maybe that's an incentive for you to join at the Friends level, at the $1,500 a year membership level. And it would sure do a lot to get us that much closer to the end of this membership campaign.
Support from listeners is what it keeps the station going. It really is our lifeblood. More than half of the money that it takes to run KERA comes from people who use the service, who listen every day, people just like you. We're not talking to some other person out there. We're talking directly to you. So please think about taking action right now. It just takes a couple of minutes, and it can take just a few dollars a month to become a sustaining member of the station. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also go online to KERA.org. Either place, you can find out about thank you gifts. You can either ask the person on the phone or check them out online. We do appreciate your participation. Again, our number, 800-456-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Fred Wendorf. We're talking about his new memoir, Desert Days, My Life as a Field Archaeologist. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So let's talk for a minute about the cover of this book, which is an extraordinary photograph. Maybe you can describe the picture for me and then tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's a picture of two of the skeletons in a graveyard which contained 58 skeletons. And the graveyard may have been a burial place for people who died violently. We can demonstrate that about 40% of them definitely were killed because they had many weapon points in their embedded in their skeleton, which shows on this picture that you've seen. The significance of this is that this was men, women, and children. 40% of them, 43% some, 44% and some. But it was these were people that they definitely wanted to kill. They wanted to kill everybody, not just the men or some man who defended them or something. This is warfare, organized warfare. And as such, it's the oldest organized warfare known anywhere in the world. This is generally recognized by the archaeological community to be true.
And 16,000 years is the age?
Well, with the you know, about radiocarbon dating, this is a 13,600 on a radiocarbon date. But when that's calibrated using other means to determine that, it's about 16,000 500 years ago.
How do you go about choosing projects for yourself?
Well, let me start out by saying that when I went to Egypt and to Sudan, I had no idea that there'd be a large quantity of archaeological sites first work. In fact, the generally held most popular view was there wasn't going to be any archaeology there. And this was another one of my stupid things, maybe stupid, that I said, well, I believe there are. There are going to be lots of sites there. And so I had a multitude of things to pick up from, and not just one or two or three or five or six. We actually recorded over 200 Paleolithic sites in our area that we'd accommodated in Sudan and Egypt. Of those, we dug 107 and reported on them as we did that work. Now, when I looked at this array of data when I first got there, and of course I didn't know very much about the archaeology at that time, but I saw that there was a number of different kinds of settlements and occasions there, and that this would represent a fairly significant period of time that was represented in these sites. And so I tried to pick sites that carried through the whole time range, and also tried to pick sites which were different kinds of archaeology. So it was a selection that we would, the archaeologists who worked with me on I've never hardly, except the Midland site, I've never really done a site on my own. I've had other people working with me. And of course, we sit down and we discuss this, and we have maybe a table laid out, and we have a bunch of the things that have been picked up on the surface, and we say, now, what is it about this that's important to you? And I would say, what is important to me, and so on. And this was a way that we arrived. It was a group decision that we would excavate this site and not this site.
One of the things you discovered was evidence of domesticated cattle before anybody thought this was happening.
And then let me tell you that's controversial. Although I think it's so simple. We have cow bones way out in the desert, around sites, archaeological sites out in the desert. And these cow bones and the sites themselves date about 9,500 to 8,500 years ago. And this is a couple of thousand years before there's domestic cattle in Southwest Asia or in Europe. It's one of the earliest evidences, anyway. I'll be a little more cautious about that and say that the domestication was being practiced. Now, why do we know that they were domesticated? Because this is a very hyper-arid region. There are basins out there where after rains, water stands for a while, several weeks, sometimes for several months. And then as it dries up, there's no water. Now, at this early stage, there's no indication that they were digging wells, no evidence at all. So that means that the cows had to be taken back somewhere where there's permanent water, and that was one of two choices. They could go to the Nile, which might be 150 miles or so away, or they could head south into Sudan, what's now Sudan. And the Nile was closer, but there were hostile people on the Nile. And they would, I think, they headed mostly south to Sudan. The problem is that we haven't been able to go in there and work ourselves because there's a lot of hostility in the area. And we're afraid that we might have more than we could handle.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Michelle in Plano. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I have a lot of respect for the professor and the work that he does, and I'm interested to find out how he would respond to critics of carbon dating and chemical analysis, people who believe that the Earth is only 6,000 years old or so, when we have paleontologists and geologists and archaeologists that all pretty much concur that that's simply inaccurate. How would he respond to that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, this is a controversy that exists in our communities. There are some people who simply have a religious conviction that the earth is only about 6,000 years old. And then there's the scientific group who have their evidence using fossils, using radiocarbon dating, using uranium dating, using all kinds of dating techniques, which support support adequately and more than adequately the idea that the Earth is much older than this initial group would accept. This is something that I've occasionally ran into in students at SMU, and I've always taken this view with the students. I'm not sure this is true for your listener, but I once had a student who was very disturbed by it, and he didn't get around to telling me that he was born-again Christian who was in conflict with the evidence that I was describing in the class until the day before his final exam. And so I arranged to meet him, and he said he wanted to drop the class. And I said, well, you've spent the whole semester here now. And I said, you really do want to leave this university as an educated man, don't you? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. You don't have to believe what I tell you. You just have to be able to repeat it to me. And I don't care what you believe. Mm-hmm. Your belief is your personal, private belief. And I'm going to hold you, though, to the information that I've given you in the class. You come on in and take that exam tomorrow. And then if you are not happy with it, we'll discuss it. But he came, took the exam, made a C, but he passed.
I have to imagine, in every branch of science, technology has changed so much over the past half century. Can you talk about the most important technological developments from your perspective that have changed the way archaeologists today are able to do their work?
Well, I think the most important one was radiocarbon dating from physics. We had a very hard time determining the true age of something before we had radiocarbon dating. Actually, the radiocarbon dating came along a little bit later than what went on in the American Southwest, where they had tree ring dating. And this was also from astronomy, the study of widths and narrow and wide rings on tree rings gave them a pattern which could be matched and could determine the age of the piece of wood that you're trying to date. There are some really remarkable things happening in regard just purely technical things that we're borrowing from other sources, such as the surveying instruments and the infrared photography and the analyses of looking for the species of the bones and the fish and the animals and so on, and the interpreting that about the environment using that data. That's playing a big role in modern archaeology.
Fred Wendorf is Henderson Morrison Professor of History, Prehistory Emeritus at SMU. His book is called Desert Days, My Life as a Field Archaeologist. Fred, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
We want to thank all of you who have called this hour to support KERA. If you would like to have a copy of Fred Wendorf's new book, Desert Days, which is a really comprehensive memoir, we weren't able to get to half of the interesting stories in the book today. We would love to be able to send that to you with our compliments when you join the station right now at 1-800-456-5372 or online at kera.org. You just make a $120 contribution or above, and it would be our pleasure to send that to you. Jeff Whittington is here with us now. He's the senior producer of Think. Jeff, I know you and I both had we were excited about this hour, and it turned out to be a great conversation.
Yeah, and I'm worried that maybe a lot of our listeners have just, oh, I'm going to listen to this. I'm not going to. And actually, you know what? I got word from Pledge Control Central, Chris, that most of the contributions this hour have been coming in via the web at KERA.org. So it's a great way for you to, you know, we're all multitasking these days. It's a great way for you to listen to the content on the station, not miss a minute of the conversation. Or, of course, this conversation is one right now that you might not mind missing too
much.
Feel
free to miss Jeff and me by picking up the phone and making your call now. We won't be offended.
Yeah, the number is 800-456-5372. Online, of course, KERA.org. And, you know, we have heard from some folks at some higher levels, Chris. I know we got a $500 contribution a few minutes ago.
Super.
This is that time in the drive. There's $225,000 left to raise. If you can see yourself joining at one of those higher levels, please do it right now. I would suggest the friends level of KERA. It's $1,500 a year. You can spread that out as a sustaining friend at $125 a month. It's very easy to work it all out. And for some of you, that's probably an affordable level. And if so, I would really encourage you to call right now, 800-456-5372. Because, you know, a larger contribution now at this point in the drive will really help us move that much farther along and wrap this campaign up as quickly as possible.
Our number, once again, is 1-800-456-5372, or you can go to KERA.org. You know, Jeff, it used to be that everybody had a checkbook register, and that would tell them what they had spent their money on. I think now a lot of us get either a debit card or a credit card online kind of review of things. And if you ever take a look at yours, and I do this on occasion just to make sure everything's balancing out, if you look at where your money goes, you think about if some archaeologist was taking a look at this and trying to figure out what it said about you and about your habits and about the things that you value. Think about the most common places. You know, a lot of us have multiple trips to the grocery store in a month. In a year, we might go shopping for clothes two or three or four times. One time a year to make a contribution to KERA, we think makes a significant statement about your valuing of ideas and of significant thought and of civil discourse that does not involve screaming and yelling, but involves intelligent people talking to one another about the things they believe passionately about. Let your checkbook statement or your online statement from your credit or debit card make this statement about you when you call 1-800-456-5372.
You can join online at KERA.org. You might choose to receive with your $200 credit or debit card contribution, tickets to see the Smothers Brothers. They're going to be here Wednesday, October 21st of this year at Nokia Theater at Grand Prairie. These are great seats. They're in the hundreds section of the Nokia Theater out there. $200 contribution on a credit or debit card. Call 800-456-5372 to get a pair of tickets to see the Smothers Brothers in October. This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth Denton. And to that end, we will bring you NPR's live anchored coverage of President Barack Obama's press conference tonight, starting at 7 p.m. You can join NPR's Robert Siegel with senior Washington editor Ron Elving and White House correspondent Don Gagne as the president marks his first 100 days in office. NPR special coverage will get underway at 7 p.m. right here on KERA 90.1. Of course, you can listen online as well at KERA.org.
I think about this all the time. There are certain stories, most stories, honestly, but you might hear a headline somewhere. You might read a snippet of something online or in the paper. So many times, I can't wait until I turn on KERA and I hear the journalist that I trust providing analysis and information and detail, because you will get more information on public radio about a lot of things and very often a different perspective. Something that is maybe the same fact, but filtered through a very different way of looking at things on public radio than you get anywhere else. We know that you value that because you come to us every single day of every single year to listen. So give us a call right now at 1-800-456-5372 or go to KERA.org. Make a contribution and support this programming. Also, enroll your name in this drawing we have for a trip for two to London.
Yeah, British Airways will fly you nonstop from DFW to London. This is business class, two seats round trip. You'll get a $1,000 Marriott gift card as well. And you also will get a tour of the BBC studios in London. So it's a great deal. Someone's going to win this trip at the end of the campaign. Just like we've said, once the last dollar is raised, about $225,000 left to go. Once that is raised, we will not only cease fundraising activity immediately, but we will draw the winner of this trip. So you could be the one if you call 800-456-5372. You can be very popular among your friends who are fans of the BBC because you'll get to pick somebody to go with you if you're the winner. You can also find out about that at kera.org.
Yeah, just imagine your ability to hold that over people's heads. You want to go with me to London? Let's see what you can do. Remember, you can also get copies of both the books we've discussed today. Desert Days by Fred Wendorf is available at the $120 contribution level as a thank you gift. We also have Satire TV, which we discussed with editor Jeffrey P. Jones in the first hour, also available with a $120 contribution. If you are interested in something, talk to the folks on the phone or check it out online, but do contact us now at 1-800-456-5372 or online at kera.org. Thank you for your support.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.